the series on Framers of Anglican Identity. This one's on John Donne, metaphysical poet and Dean of St. Paul's. I'm assisted today by my beautiful assistant, Blaine O'Brien. We're reading some poems of John Donne, so get a break from my voice. And we've been going through those poems yesterday just to make sure we're all agreed about what the texts mean and how to read them properly. I want to begin, first of all, as I did last time, with a bit of an overview and summary of the situation on the ground in the Church of England at the time of John Donne. We're now into the reign of James I at the beginning of the 17th century. The way in which the Church of England is attempting to operate right now is by insisting on outward conformity to the Book of Common Prayer for those who live in the Atlantic Islands. The deal is that there's no desire on the part of the church or the state to police people's private thoughts about religion. There's no interest in a confessional church, in other words, saying you have to believe this, 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 and this, or in a highly disciplined, regulated style of church life, which we recall last week was what the Puritans have been pushing for. But the deal is you turn up, you take part in the common worship of the Book of Common Prayer, and that's enough. However, in this church, Catholic externals have been abolished in religion, both in church furnishings and in liturgical gear. That is to say, the clergy predominantly wear choir dress, usually cassocks, surplices, academic hoods, and black scarves. The Mass has been abolished. The oath of supremacy is compulsory for the clergy and for civil office holders. That is to say, you have to take an oath recognising the monarch as the head of the church and repudiating the authority of the Bishop of Rome over the Church of England. It's also necessary, if you wish to take a degree at Oxford or Cambridge, to take the oath of supremacy and to subscribe to the 39 articles to say you believe in this is what the central tenets of religion are about. There are fines for not attending the local parish church. And this creates the hope that Catholicism would be a religion that would wither away as its adherents gradually conformed. So what was the actual Elizabethan situation on the ground? There had been difficulty in Protestantising and evangelising of people with low educational standards, conservative habits and instincts, who were little interested in a zealous religion that seemed hostile to their pleasures. Sufficient preachers couldn't be had for such a sermonising style of religion or for catechising their other main educational instrument. That is to say, and some of you probably raised in this, that in preparation for confirmation you had to learn the catechism by heart, and you would have been tested on that regularly. And this all comes from the time of the Reformation. This is a good way, it's a very effective instrument for people who are just starting out on their educational journey. So the problem, the chief problem of the Elizabethan Church is to create an educated clergy who can write sermons of their own. And remember what we agreed last time, that what often happened was that Cranmer and co. would write collections of sermons and say, you can't preach, read from this. This is what you do. Because before that, in many churches, you never heard a sermon from one Sunday to the next. So the Puritans were the ones who were trying to create and insist on what I've just been talking about there, but there weren't enough preachers to be had, or they weren't large enough a party to capture the commanding heights of the Elizabethan Church. The problem is, do the clergy there and the leaders of the church become leftovers, the compromisers? That is to say, if you're not a zealous Puritan, and you're not highly educated, are you just sort of carrying on the job because you're just by the instincts of what was there in the past? So it's the problem of creating a sufficiently highly motivated clerical leadership on the ground at local level. Well, what were the strategies of the Catholic minority who wanted to keep the old ways and to survive under the Elizabethan Church? The Catholic remnant was particularly strong in the north of England. These were called church papists. Well, one way was for the head of the family to go to the parish church just enough to avoid fines. You wouldn't be there every Sunday, but you'd be there to make sure that the roll keepers were satisfied that you wouldn't have a fine levied on you, while your wife was left at home. Remember, she's a legal non-person in Elizabethan England, and she would have responsibility for raising the children as Catholics, to protect and organise Catholic priests and their services, and to keep a Catholic tenor to their family life. So these people in the north of England were generally nobility and gentry. Some parish clergy outwardly conformed to the new ways, using the Book of Common Prayer, while covertly celebrating the Mass for those who liked the old ways. A dangerous double game, depending on the fact that there would be no informers to tell the bishop what you're up to. There were also, from the Marian era, priests sacked from their posts under Elizabeth's accession, who quietly went about their clandestine parish business. They weren't the vicar anymore. They were just quietly circulating around the local community, celebrating the Mass. Now, one of the things that's going to come up this week, and particularly next week, when we talked about Richard Baxter, is, I mean, in 1662, was what was called the Grand Ejection, when several thousand clergy were booted out of their parishes because they refused to accept the return of episcopacy and the Book of Common Prayer. There had also been a mass booting out of clergy when the Charles I lost the Civil War and Cromwell insisted on abolishing the episcopacy and the Book of Common Prayer. But it's now thought by historians that perhaps the greatest booting out of all of clergy took place when Elizabeth I came to the throne and said, "I'm sorry, guys, now we'll be going flip-flopping all these ways. Catholicism is definitely out now, and if you wish to keep your living, you have to take the oath of supremacy, use the Book of Common Prayer, and accept the bishops I have chosen." And quite a few clergy refused to do that and were without a living, without an income, and would depend, I guess, on being supported from the private income of these Catholic families. There were other parts of the Catholic community who were called recusants. These were the diehards who stayed away from the parish church, paid the requisite fines. The Elizabethan state was not always efficient in collecting fines anyway, and continued with Catholic worship and with sheltering priests and remained steadfastly loyal. And we need to understand that John Donne's family are in this group of recusants. His mother and stepfather, in fact, went into exile and lived outside England from 1595 onwards. John Donne's original father had died relatively young. John Donne had inherited quite a bit of money, which he spent pretty much right away on books, women, and travel. He had an uncle who was a Jesuit priest, who was driven into exile, who was lucky not to be executed, and his brother Henry was at either Oxford or Cambridge. He made his confession to one of these covert Catholic priests. He was denounced shortly afterwards. He was arrested. He gave way under torture and revealed the identity and location of the Catholic priest, who in turn was captured and executed. And the brother Henry was put into jail, and of course the Elizabethan jails weren't terribly hygienic places, and he died of the plague. And this created a real crisis of conscience in John Donne's heart and mind, as we can understand. Particularly because Donne is a very ambitious high achiever who wants to get on in the Elizabethan state, which is what he can't do if he goes on being a Catholic. So there's a real tension in Donne's conscience about a decision to join the Church of England. Now, there are two major crises in the Catholic community in the Elizabethan years. First of all, in 1570, the Pope issues a papal bull excommunicating Elizabeth I as a heretic and commanding her, his Catholic loyalists not to obey her, and really saying, if you assassinate her, you're doing God's will. This created a huge problem for the Catholic community. The Catholic state needed to absolve obeying her, and remember, the Elizabethan state would insist on Catholics being loyal. Now, in the 20th century, one of the great accusations against Pope Pius XII is, why didn't he oppose Hitler and command Catholics not to obey him in all the German lands and the Empire of the Reich? And one of the reasons for that is that it was widely recognised, even within the Curia, that this decision in 1570 had been a bad one, it had badly boomeranged on the Catholic community, and it was a reluctance to do that again and create the same crisis of conscience for the Catholic community. The second crisis came with the Spanish Armada in 1588, when, of course, if Philip had succeeded, there would have been a restoration by force of Catholicism in Britain. And once again, the loyalist Catholic community was seen as a disloyal minority. And finally, of course, the gunpowder plot. Up until recent times, there was actually a collect, an official, you know, feast of celebration of the thwarting of the gunpowder plot. The you may recall that English couple who renewed their marriage vows here at St. Peter's recently. One of his distant ancestors had taken part in the gunpowder plot, a member of the Northamptonshire gentry, and he too would have been arrested, tortured, and executed. This created the reimposition of the oath of allegiance for all concerned.
Is
it anything
to do with
Guy Fawkes? Yes, precisely. Guy Fawkes was created by James I, isn't it? That government as a way, a popular celebration, and joins along with Fox's Book of Martyrs, which had a huge impact in creating a very anti-Catholic feeling amongst people in the Atlantic Isles, and that was exported, I think, to New Zealand as well to a limited extent. And of course, a direct import into the sectarian politics of Northern Ireland, I might add. So in summary, Catholicism becomes a stubbornly persisting underground sect, relatively small, relatively supported by the gentry and the nobility, waiting for its renewal in the 19th century, when of course massive Irish immigration will give it mass support, and also there'll be very high profile defections from Anglicanism to Roman Catholicism. We'll be hearing more about that at other times. Proportionally more Catholic priests were judicially murdered in Britain than in many other Protestant European societies. And I remember a few years back on study leave visiting a friend of mine who I trained with for the ministry and who had bailed out to become a Roman Catholic priest over the ordination of women, and going to his church, and in the sacristy was a list of the local martyrs of all those who bumped off in the 16th century. So the Catholic community in Britain has a very vivid and continuing memory of those who stuck to their guns and suffered a cruel death. When Margaret Clitheroe, I think, was one of the most recently canonised ones. I've also failed to mention the fact that as that first generation of priests who were on the highways and the byways died out, there were, of course, Jesuits who were specially delegated off to look after the English Catholic community, trained in the seminary in France in Douai, highly motivated, highly educated, highly disciplined, ironically, exactly the kind of clergy the Protestant Reformation wanted to see. They infiltrated their way into Britain to exercise a ministry of caring for Catholic families and attempting to win converts. Often there was considerable tension between these Jesuits and the local gentry who didn't want to rock the boat, didn't want to call attention to themselves, and didn't want to create trouble.
But who were Catholics?
Yes, yes, right. And also the local clergy, Catholic priests, who, again, felt a bit supplanted and usurped in some cases. And the most inspiring example of these peoples, in terms of the martyrs, is Edmund Campion, who had in fact been a courtier at the to Elizabeth I, very educated, very witty, very able person, but who was prepared to be martyred. I think he was really hung, drawn, and quartered. So John Donne grows up in this kind of a context, and he goes to Oxford in the 1580s, but of course he can't take a degree because he won't sign up to the 39 Articles. You were allowed to go to Oxford or Cambridge, go to lectures, go to seminars, pass exams, but you wouldn't get a degree unless you signed up to the 39 Articles. He then goes to London and takes up his legal studies. He's immensely able intellectually and is a wordsmith. And this is the period of his love poetry and erotic verse, which for many followers of his poetry is more significant than his religious verse. And we're now going to hear the poem, The Flea. The context of this poem is he's trying to persuade a woman to sleep with him, who's covering a certain amount of erotic resistance. And, you know, he's saying, What's your problem about the exchange of intimate bodily fluids that may follow from this? This flea has already extracted blood from both of us, this sharing of intimate bodily fluids has already occurred. And the woman concerned has killed the flea, and there's a kind of guilt motif that works out here. So, fair enough, everybody.
Mark but the spleen, and mark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first, and now sucks thee. And in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Thou knowest that this cannot be said, a sin nor shame nor loss of maidenhead. Yet this enjoys before it woo, and pampered swells with one blood made of two. But this, alas, is more than we would do. O stay, three lives in one flea spare, where we almost, yea, more than married are. This flea is you and I, and this our marriage bed, and marriage temple is. Though parents grudge, and you wear met and cloistered in these living walls of jet, thou use make you act to kill me. Let not to that self-murder added be, and sacrilege three sins in killing three. Cruel and sudden hast thou since purpled thy nail in blood of innocence. Wherein could this flea guilty be, except in that drop which it sucked from thee? Yet thou triumphst, and sayest thou, findest not thyself nor me the weaker now. 'Tis true, then learn how false fears be, just so much honour when thou yield'st to me, will waste as this flea's death took life from thee.
Just going to say something quickly about metaphysical poetry. It's a very intellectual, witty style of poetry. You take an idea and you take another theme from that realm, that cluster of ideas, and you're going to blow it up and develop it in extraordinary ways into a conceit, as it's called. And you create a tension in the poetry between two poles of that idea. Now, what we have here is John Donne as an ambitious, proud, self-absorbed, arrogant, restless narcissist. That is to say, a person very much involved with himself, thinks about himself, and getting on is what matters. My pleasure, my sense of intellectual supremacy, it's moi, moi, moi all the way. His other blind spots that have been noticed by critics, he's not much interested in nature or in creation. You don't hear about that at all in his poetry. He's unable to get inside the mind of the women he writes about or empathise with them, for all he thinks about romantic love and sex a great deal. He fulfils the classic feminist critique about objectifising women, you know, their bodies are its. Of course, the feminist critics are outraged by John Donne, and perhaps they're not always fair to him. Now, in this period, he's attached to a great family he's trying to get on with. He falls in love with a 16-year-old called Anne Moore, who is the niece of the guy he works for, and he covertly marries her. Now, this creates a great deal of trouble for him. In fact, his employer briefly imprisons him on this reckoning. He's eventually let out of prison. They're given a very small dowry. But the intriguing thing is that a man who's obsessed about getting on, who's incredibly ambitious, has made a marriage which has destroyed his career and his possibilities of advancement. And he will spend the next considerable period of his life living in penury while their family grows. So he is married for love and destroyed his career. The 13 years of penury follows, desperately trying to find money for a growing brood. They say in Wales that there are some men just have to look at a woman to get her pregnant. Well, he was doing more than that. They had 12 children in the end. And we have to, the remarkable thing is he still manages to retain his intellectual discipline, devouring books, annotating them, breaking them down into copious notes. He's very well read in theology, in patristic era, the first 6 centuries of the church's theology, as well as in classical and contemporary literature. And he did this by getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning when the screaming rugrats got going. So we have to imagine him desperately trying to find employment, desperately trying to concentrate on his work. They're always just one step ahead of the red line in a family that grows and grows. But marriage changes him, and these are years of considerable and profound change in him as a human being. An education and love for God, and about being a rather more unselfish human being. Anne died not long after his ordination in 1617, having just given birth to their 12th child when he was 49.
So had he taken the oath of supremacy?
Yes, we're about to come up to this now. There's a long period of shall I, shan't I, floating in the wilderness, of receiving offers of advancement and preferment. If only you've come across to us, because of course the Elizabethan Church is keen to recruit the best and the brightest of those from the Catholic community, both to behead it of an able people and to recruit them into its own ranks. So he becomes, in this period, an intellectual gun for hire. For instance, there's a great Elizabethan expedition to Cadiz and the Azores against the Spanish, and he goes along that expedition as a kind of recorder of events there. He has periods of depression. In fact, in this period, he wrote a confused book arguing the case for suicide. He later tried to cover this book up and to deny he'd ever written it. He becomes an effective propagandist for James I and the Church of England. So he hasn't taken orders yet, but he's already helping the cause in that way. James I encourages him to take orders, to join the team with the prospect of preferment. So Dunn is tempted but uncertain in this era, and he's genuinely drawn to a deeper call to follow Christ. But he's a person of mixed motives, and it's a time of considerable inattention. And we're now going to hear the poem Good Friday, Riding Westward, 1613. Now, this is the idea that on Good Friday, that he should be staying at home to keep the Passion, the celebration of the Passion. He's in fact riding towards the West. The West is always a similar image of death in Dunn's poetry. He's riding away from, he turns his back on Christ's crucifixion. And the conceit here is the idea, we call it gravitational pull, they didn't know about gravity then, that spheres are an image of perfection, and it's the idea that, you know, spheres are pulled by magnetic attraction. And he's been riding westward, whereas inwardly he's been pulled back to the east of where all the good effects of Christ's passion are. And at the end we'll hear about him, you know, maybe I can't bear to turn around and face you as I should, but you're both kind of a purgatorial process, you're both whipping me and burning off my rust, as it were, in this period before I'm able to do this. So it's
So he continued to write poetry all through this busy time when he was poor with all these children?
Yes, he did.
Right. Yes. Never stopped writing poetry.
Right. Thank you.
Let man's soul be a sphere, and then in this the intelligence that moves devotion is. And as the other spheres, by being grown, subject to foreign motion, lose their own, and by being others hurried every day, scarcely ere their natural form obey. Pleasure or business, so our souls admit, or their first mover, and are whirled by it. Hence isn't that I am carried towards the west this day, when my soul's form bends to the east. There I should see a sun by rising set, and by that setting end this day beget. And that Christ on his cross did rise and fall, sin had eternally benighted all. Yet dare I almost be glad, I do not see that spectacle of too much weight for me. Who sees God's face, that is self-life, must die. What a death were it then to see God die? It made his own lieutenant, nature, shrink. It made his footstool crack and the sun wink. Could I behold those hands which span the poles and tune all spheres at once, pierced with those holes? Could I behold that endless fight which is zenith to us all and our antipodes? Humbled below us, or that blood which is the seat of all our souls, if not of his, made dirt of dust, or that flesh which was worn, if on these things I durst not look, durst I on his distressed mother cast mine eye, who was God's partner here, and furnished thus half of that sacrifice which ransomed us. Though these things as I ride before my from mine eye, they're present yet unto my memory. For that looks towards them, and thou looks towards me. O Saviour, as thou hang'st upon the tree, I turn my back to thee, but to receive corrections, till thy mercies bid thee leave. O think me worth thine anger, punish me, burn off my rust and my deformity. Restore thine image so much by thy grace, that thou mayst know me, and I'll turn my face.
Now, in 1615, he accepts ordination as priest of the Church of England. He becomes immediately chaplain to Lincoln's Inn Fields, where he's ministering to predominantly people in the legal fraternity. It's an educated audience, an encouraging atmosphere for his infant career as a preacher. He tours other Church of England churches, listens to other preachers, and he's keen to get on in the church. In 1621, he hits the big time and is made the Dean of St. Paul's. By now, he's a widower. His children have grown up and gone away, except for his daughter Constance, who becomes his housekeeper for the rest of his life. Now, deans, when they come into a job, always have a choice. Shall I concentrate on being a preacher or a renovator? That is to say, cathedrals are always in trouble as buildings. And some deans become great fundraisers and changers of cathedrals. And that's, it's become even more that now. We now have the cult of the celebrity dean who'll do anything to raise money. And Dunn makes a deliberate choice, because we're not talking about the old St. Paul's that now exists, we're talking about the wooden cathedral that existed prior to the Great Fire of London in 1688. It had many things wrong with it, and Dunn chose to make running repairs just to keep things going and concentrate on a powerful preaching ministry to the City of London and to the court. And those would argue that that's what a dean's job really is, to develop a powerful preaching ministry to the city. He would preach at least once a week, usually for an hour, off notes, not of a deliberate complete text, often memorized. His sermons were only written out for publication, in which case they grew. As published, they would take 2 to 3 hours to preach. It's not a preaching style we find immediately accessible. Modern readers have to chop it up into bits to appreciate them. And we can note David McCulloch's point last week about those who follow the Elizabethan settlement, the avant-garde conformists who prize what Queen Elizabeth I prized, which was well-ordered choral cathedral worship as a major priority. So this has now become an enduring archetypal symbol of what Anglicanism stands for across the world. There will usually be a cathedral with a paid choir of a reasonably high standard. Now, some of the well-known quotes from Dunn's sermon. Remember Hemingway's novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls? That's a direct quote from one of his sermons. No man is an island. That's another quote. The thing he had on the front cover of the Pebble last week, all occasions invite his mercies and all times are his seasons. That comes from one of his Christmas sermons. Yes. So he's a preacher also to the royal court regularly over 15 years. Whitehall then had a population of about 1,700 people. He's also a vicar and a preacher to the Church of St. Dunstan's in the West. So we now turn to what Dunn believed. He shared his age's penitential spirituality. And we're going to hear now the poem, A Hymn to God the Father, which was on the front cover of Pebble in Lent, and is a very good poem to meditate on in Lent.
Wilt thou forgive that sin where I begun, which was my sin, though it were done before? Wilt thou forgive that sin through which I run, and do run still, though still I do deplore? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. Wilt thou forgive that sin which I have won others to sin and made my sin their door? Wilt thou forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. I have a sin of fear, that when I have spun my last thread, I shall perish on the shore. But swear by thyself that at my death, thy sun shall shine as he sun shines now and heretofore. And having done that, thou hast done, I fear no more.
Well, we've heard a lot about what the Church of England was against or didn't insist on, but just before she died, Queen Elizabeth I said this to her Parliament in 1598, and it's supposed to be the archetypal statement of what the Church of England believed. The estate and government of this Church of England, as it now standeth in this Reformation, both in form and doctrine, is agreeable with scriptures, with the most ancient general councils, that is to say the big ecumenical councils, with the practice of the primitive church, and with the judgment of all the old learned fathers. So this is a path between the excesses of Rome and the abstinences of Geneva, as one person put it, and Dunn is well qualified to pursue this path. He had a feeling for the Via Media, the middle way, which expressed itself in the continuing dialogue between scriptures, tradition, and reason, in the appeal to the authority of the early fathers of the church, and in an openness to new learning, in a commitment to the historic continuity of the Catholic Church, and in the freedom of the national churches. In other words, there's a considerable point to each church having a nation, having a church peculiar and particular to its own national genius. He belonged to the sizable group in the church under James I, which was in important ways Puritan without being fully Calvinist. Like many other sensitive Christians, Dunn became full of wonder that such a sinner as he could be loved by the all-holy God, and he could draw no conclusion other than the belief that God had freely chosen to love, or elect, choose to salvation, him, as he had freely chosen to elect everyone, included those who persistently rebelled against his good purposes for them. This was the version of predestination which appealed to the greatest modern theologian in the Calvinist or Reformed tradition, Karl Barth. In other words, God has chosen us for salvation. He says nothing at all about who he chose for reprobation or damnation. As he put it, in an age when men could be recruited for the army or navy by force, Christ beat his drum, but he chose not to press men. Now you press them into the thwart. Christ is served by voluntaries. To put it in a more theological terms, Dunn believed in election, the choice by God of whom to save among sinners, but he had no sympathy with the belief that before anyone was created, God had already decided exactly who was to be a reprobate, perpetually incapable of hearing and obeying him. His teaching was unambiguous. God does not reward or condemn out of his decrees, but out of our actions we choose not to be saved. Now, here I have to say a point where the Church of England comes to a fundamental disagreement with Reformed, Calvinistic, Puritan religion on the continent. The Synod of Dort takes place in the early 17th century, and Dunn is sent as one of the representatives of the English Church to that. It was the most representative gathering of European-wide Protestantism, and it was the Dutch Reformed Church called the Synod to deal with the issue of Arminianism. Now, when John Calvin died, his successor, Theodore Beza, was the one who drew out conclusions from the doctrine of predestination which Calvin hadn't, and that is the belief that God had chosen some people from all eternity to be damned. And Arminius had rejected this and had moved on to reject the whole doctrine of predestination. The Synod of Dort was called to deal with Arminianism, as it was called, and to reject it, which it did, and to begin a persecution of the reprobates. Dunn preached a sermon at the Synod and had to rather tactfully tone down his own opposition to what was being taught there. At that point, the Church of England begins to grow away from Dutch Calvinism and Reformed religion, and more the Church of England turns in on itself and becomes cut off from the sources of European continental theology. It's a key turning point. It's clear that Donne's own beliefs were those which the Synod condemned as Arminian heresy, and increasingly the Church of England will become Arminian in its theology. For those of you who were here last Tuesday evening, the most interesting theological row broke out between Father Carl Summers Edgar and Father Chris Holmes, who teaches systematics at Target on the doctrine of predestination, which I said was a replay of the Synod of Dort. The faith which Donne proclaimed was that a faith that God's will is that all can be saved and that Christ has died for the benefit of all, declaring the divine love for all, but that sinners can resist God's will even to the end. Now, in his Eucharistic theology, he accepted a high church theology about the Eucharist, one of the many survivals from his Roman Catholic upbringing. He taught firmly that the communion table is an altar, and in the sacrament there is a sacrifice. Not only a sacrifice of thanksgiving, common to all the congregation, but a sacrifice peculiar to the priest, through him, though for the people. He has an ecumenical vision, like Lancelot Andrews and Hooker. He has a dislike of theological hatred. His religious poetry. Well, now we come to the Holy Sonnets. And can I just say that, you know, one of the strands about being an Anglican, about being a member of the Church of England, is that poetry matters to Anglicans. I could have chosen to give a lecture on George Herbert, but it would have been less interesting because his career was so brief. He died after a few years as a country parson. But his poetry, some would argue, was even better. And that whereas Anglicans have not tended to be terribly interested in systematic theology, which is a great shame in my opinion, they have always been interested in poetry and seen it as an integral part of their faith. And this is why, one of the reasons why I've chosen John Donne.
Right down to R.S. Thomas.
Absolutely, I could have chosen him too and talked about him.
Wonderful parish priest, but his poetry is the best modern poetry to come out of Wales.
Yes, it is indeed. So we're going to hear first of all that very well-known poem, That in My Heart, Three Person God. And you know, this poem is quite shocking. This person wants to turn to God, wants to let God into his life, but a whole lot of kind of the unconverted hinterland of his life is resisting it. And it's the image of a besieged city, which God will have to be like a besieged who breaks in. It's also like conquering a woman, and one critic has compared, saying that he's making God like a rapist, really. Let's hear this extraordinary poem.
Fetter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I like a usurped town to another due. Labour to admit you, but owe to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is kept it, and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but I am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie, or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you withdraw me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me.
Now we're going to hear the poem At the Round Earth's Imagined Corners Blow. Now, this refers to the teaching, I think it's in Corinthians, that in fact we don't eternally die. It's the problem is that after death, there's a general resurrection of the dead when the trumpets are blown by the angels. All rise, all are reconnected with their bodies. And then comes the general judgment. There's a second rising if you are to be saved. And this poem will finish about the need for penitence now. Time's brief, time to get myself sorted out. So let's listen to it. It gets extraordinary into the images that he used.
At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise, Arise from death, you numberless infinities of souls, and to your scattered bodies go, all whom the flood did and fire shall overthrow, all whom were earth, dearth, age, ague's tyrannies, despair, law, chance hath slain, and you whose eyes shall behold God and never taste death's woe. But let them sleep, Lord, and be mourn a space, for if above all these my sins abound, 'tis late to ask abundance of thy grace. When we are there, here on this lowly ground, teach me how to repent, for that's as good as if thou hadst sealed my pardon with thy blood.
In other words, he's rejecting the Roman Catholic doctrine of purgatory. There won't be a second chance after death. You have to get yourself sorted out now. And now the poem, Death Be Not Proud. Now this is using taunt language. It's based on 1 Corinthians 15, and death is being mocked. Yes, here we go.
Death be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st and thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, make pleasure. Then from thee much more must flow, and soonst as our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls' delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well. And better than my stroke, thou swell'st now then, one short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die.
So this is feeding off Paul's observation that death is the last enemy. And the final poem we're going to hear is A Hymn to My God in My Sickness. And this takes a bit of explanation. In fact, it was written not long before Donne's death. And he imagines his body, he's stretched out on a sick bed, the doctors bending over him to do what they can for him. And he imagines that his body is a great map of the world. And these doctors have become geographers, or cosmographers, as he puts it. And they're looking in particular at that space between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean through the Cape of Good Hope. And he's proceeding into the west of the Pacific Ocean, which is an image of death, and the Cape of Good Hope are the straits, the Magellan Straits, through which will be the difficult point of going through the gates of death. And beyond death is the richness of the Pacific and the unknown regions of Asia, which has become image of eternal life. So he imagines, as he contemplates the prospect of a painful death, his imagination fastens on a new symbol. Reviving the legend which he mentioned in Metempsychosis, he sees that at the centre of the world is Adam's tree, which becomes Christ's cross. People believe from the patristic times on the tree from the centre of the world, which was the tree in the Garden of Eden, which Adam, the apple had come from. And this tree becomes, wood from that was used for Christ's cross. It was the first Adam who sinned and fell, and it's the second Adam, Christ, who puts that right. And the other image that begins all this with is the idea of tuning his body as a music instrument that's been tuned outside the door of heaven with the company of saints. It's much got in tune with the company of saints. You can go, you're admitted into the room then. And finally he preaches my sermon to mine own self within the lesson that the Lord throws down in order to raise. From an ocean of death he may be raised to resurrection as eastern riches may be found by sailing into the Pacific. Let's see this remarkable poem.
Hymn to God in my sickness. Since I am come to that holy room, where, with thy choir of saints forevermore, I shall be made thy music. As I come, I tune the instrument here at the door, and what I must do then, think here before. Whilst my physicians, by their love are grown cosmographers, and I their map, who lie flat on this bed, that by them may be shown that this is my southwest discovery, per fretum febris, by these straits to die. I joy that in these straits I see my west, for though these currents yield return to none, what shall my west hurt me? As west and east, in all flat maps, and I am one, are one, so death doth touch the resurrection. Is the Pacific Sea my home? Or are eastern riches? Is Jerusalem, Anion and Magellan and Gibraltar? All straits, and none but straits are ways to them, whether where Japheth dwelt, or Cham or Shem. We think that Paradise and Calvary, Christ's cross and Adam's tree, stood in one place. Look, Lord, and find both Adams met in me. As the first Adam's sweat surrounds my face, may the last Adam's blood my soul embrace. So, in his purple wrapped, receive me, Lord. By these his thorns, give me his other crown. And as to other souls, I preach thy word. Be this my text, my sermon to mine own. Therefore, that he may raise, the Lord throws down.
Donne talked towards the end of his life about man being a future animal. In death, a human being dies like an animal, yet for humanity, death is a fulfillment of a lifelong feeling that something better must lie ahead. Creatures of an inferior nature are possessed with the present. Man is a future creature. In a holy and useful sense, we may say that God is a future God. To man especially, he is so. Man's consideration of God is especially for the future. That's a direct quote from Donne. He died in 1631, so this is towards the end of the reign of James I, and he will not live to see the chaos that will follow as Charles I leads the nation into civil war, and the Cromwellian protectorate will follow, and then after 15 years of the abolition of the Church of England, the restoration of the Church of England. And that's what we're going to be talking about next Tuesday, when we talk about James, Richard Baxter, the great Puritan divine, who posits a kind of alternative future that the Church of England might have followed. Thank you for your attention.